With your help, we can continue to fight for freedom. This is not possible without your generosity. Join our quest for the truth and our freedom. Simply visit www.realitycheck.radio/donate to make a difference today.
Good morning, everyone. You're on Reality Check Radio, Real Talk with Rodney Hyde. And it's special time when we get our Western A price guru, Phyllis Titchener, on the show to talk nutrition and health. Good morning, Phyllis.
Good morning, Rodney. Great to be here.
It's so wonderful to have you on and share with us and lift our eating habits. Now, we've got a bit of feedback from listeners. Are you able to go through that with us first before we get into things?
Sure. We have had, you folks have had feedback from a fellow named John, who asserts humans were not designed to eat the flesh of dead animals. Our teeth are designed to grind food. Our intestinal tract is long and alkaline to digest plant foods. Meat-eating animals are fast-running with claws to catch and hold their prey. They have fangs to rip the meat. They have a short intestinal tract, which is very acidic, to digest the meat and to pass it through quickly before putrefaction takes place, in opposed to what he is asserting is our long and alkaline digestive tract. Okay. So he goes on to talk about vegan bodybuilders. Having been a vegetarian for 22 years and how that helped him. And he goes on to mention the book or assert the book, The China Study, is a good basis for why vegetarian diets, supposedly SOP, those people in various parts of China eat. For many generations, are the best diet. Okay, those who ate predominantly a plant food diet had superior health than those groups that ate a meat diet and not in the amount that we Westerners do. Okay, so all the best from John. Okay, so having said that, are you okay with me? Do you have any comment or would you like me to say what my response to John is?
Well, it's a good debate, but I always believe that we should keep it extremely civil.
Mm. Oh, absolutely.
And also, it's like to elucidate and understand the differences and the rationale and the reasons. Yeah. And because it seems to me the funniest thing in the world that we would argue over what we each eat, if you know what I mean. It's like... But so I don't like it as an argument,
absolutely,
but I love it as a discussion and a debate.
Great.
So that vegetarians and carnivores can learn from each other.
Absolutely. Thank you for adding that in. As a Weston A. Price chapter leader, I base much of my core principles about healthy eating that delivers healthy people and healthy babies and a healthy society are based on the works of Dr. Weston A. Price that we've gone over a little bit in the past. First up, share that he was very concerned about the deterioration that he observed in his dental practice with people's teeth being more crooked, with children being ill, with adults having chronic diseases that he didn't remember from his own childhood. So he went around the world looking for what were people traditionally eating, and was it true that they had very few cavities, no crooked teeth, and were very, very healthy without hospitals or more modern medicine and those kinds of interventions. And he did find that on the whole, people who were tribes who were isolated from the foods of modern commerce were eating their traditional diets in sync with their environment. They did not have crooked teeth. They had very few cavities, and they did not have the inflammatory disorders that people around the world, and certainly his patients in Cleveland, Ohio, were experiencing. So no, very little cancer, heart disease was unknown, inflammatory disorders like autoimmune disease or crossed eyes or crooked legs, those things weren't happening. So he actually set out, he confides in his book, Nutrition and Physical Degeneration, published in 1939, that he was hoping to find vegetarian cultures who had were eating their traditional diet, which was included no animal products or certainly no flesh meats, that they would be healthier. And he expressed his disappointment that that wasn't actually the case. So I encourage people to go onto the Weston A. Price website or look for Dr. Price's book, Nutrition and Physical Degeneration, if you want to get to the hardcore science of what he found. But ultimately, he did not find any purely vegetarian or certainly not vegan traditional cultures or people anywhere that he went. If they could get a hold of seafood or insects or flesh of animals and certainly egg yolks, they were into them. And in fact, those higher fat, like egg yolks or butter or seafood, like eggs, like kina or salmon roe, those foods were considered sacred by many cultures that he studied. And they were if they were in short supply, they were reserved particularly for pregnant women or soon to conceive couples, because they understood that the fat-soluble vitamins concentrated in those sacred foods were key to a successful pregnancy and a healthy, fully formed baby, which was, they understood, the basis of their society being able to continue, that they function as a society without a raft of birth defects or, you know, children and people who did not think particularly well because their neurology was deranged by lack of saturated animal fats, vitamins A, D, E, K2, and in some instances, conjugated linoleic acid in their diets, particularly in the diets of pregnant women, older people, and young children who were still actively growing. So that's my basis for encouraging people to use saturated animal fats. Now, I'm the first person to admit that we don't actually have a world shortage of protein. This is global protein shortage is not the problem I see. Global saturated animal fat and true natural fat-soluble vitamin sources are the problem I see, because we have been demonizing saturated animal fat on the unfounded, concocted narrative from the 1920s onwards that heart disease, hardening of the arteries, blockages in the heart are caused by consumption of animal fat, which skewed us purposefully, big PR campaign, to reject saturated animal fats and the butter and pork lard that we had been eating and skew us towards supposedly heart-healthy fats / oils from industrial seed oils, which is what I'm proposing we talk about today. So saturated animal fats are very, very important as the best source of actual human usable vitamin A, D, E, and K2. Now, John asserts that our teeth are designed to grind food. Yes, they're also designed to grind meat, and we may not have fangs, so to speak, but we do have dog or eye teeth, which are perfectly those more pointed teeth on either side of your front two teeth. Those are designed for ripping meat or whatever you need to rip. Animals that eat meat have a short intestinal tract, which is very acidic. Well, we don't have a particularly long intestinal tract. It's certainly much shorter than bonobos and gorillas, sort of our nearest relatives, if you will, in the primate family. And we absolutely do have an extremely acidic stomach, somewhere between pH of 1 and 2, in order to digest, to begin to break down meat. So yes, the first part of our digestive organ, our stomach, is highly acidic. And when it isn't, we run into problems. We run into heartburn, which actually is caused by insufficient stomach acid.
Acid. pH 1 to 2, that's extremely acid.
Yes, it is.
I'm amazed that your intestine can hold it.
Well, it doesn't hold it for very long. It has, protective tissue endothelium in the stomach. And when there's not actually stomach in your food,
the
pH does rise, so it's not as corrosive. But the problem is we have tended to have very little iodine in our diets. It's not considered important or essential. We've been encouraged to reduce salt, both of which mean that it's hard for us to get the pH down to the ideal acid level to completely digest our food, or our chyme, as it's called, the sort of slurry of broken down bits of food that ideally needs to be at around pH 2 before that sphincter, that little muscle out of the bottom of our stomachs, allows our chyme, our partially digested food, to move into our small intestine. Because it's not supposed to be alkaline when it goes in there. It's meant to be acidic. And there are mechanisms that, try to prevent us from moving food on before it's sufficiently acidic and therefore pre-digested or broken down. So my thoughts on that. Plus, we actually, we have a fairly long small intestine and a fairly short large intestine. That's the opposite of animals who are designed to eat vegetation and plants. Okay, so we may be some kind of hybrid in there, so to speak, between strictly vegetarians and strictly carnivores, but we are definitely, we have the same proportion and the same pH of animals who are scavengers. So we started out there with the jackals scavenging what the big predators like the cats left behind on the plains of Africa, just simplistically. Okay, so to say we weren't designed to eat meat, I think that's a stretch. Okay.
And the China study?
And the China study. The book, The China Study, was written probably a good 20, 25 years ago by Professor Campbell of Harvard University. What I asserted was, well, I tried to assert, and I'm sorry if there was misunderstanding, the China study is not about feeding rats powdered milk. It is, as John says, it's about the lifestyle of the Chinese people and what they eat. Okay, absolutely. Food and family meals are a tremendously important part of any culture, and the Chinese seem to have held on to that better than we have in the West. Now, the question of them predominantly eating a plant food diet, yes, there are lots of plant foods in China. That doesn't necessarily mean that they're continuously healthy or that that diet hasn't changed dramatically like ours has in the last 100 and 120 years, okay? One of the more revered or venerated foods in the traditional Chinese cuisine is pork. And yes, there are a lot of people, there weren't a lot of pigs at times, certainly in the last 70 to 80 years as China went through successive waves of political disruption and in many instances, starvation and their whole food economy collapsing. So saying that they eat a plant food, predominantly plant food diet, yes, they may do that. But when given the opportunity, they absolutely will consume pork and eggs, a big part of all of their traditional recipes. So to say that they're vegetarian or they prefer to be vegetarian, I don't think that's the complete picture. Now, the China study science or assertion that we should not be eating animal protein, which is my understanding of what Campbell was getting at, is not based on what the Chinese people eat. The assertion that animal protein is not good for animals to eat was based on a laboratory rat study in which they fed lab rats exclusively large quantities of powdered milk.
Okay. Oh my goodness.
Rats don't normally eat powdered milk. There are no rats out there running powdered milk factories. When you give any animal a mono diet and something that is not normal for them, it's understandable that they would be sick. Okay, so if people are interested in looking into this whole topic, absolutely read the China study, but you won't find that information in there unless you dig down into some obscure footnotes. But a woman nutritionist, Denise Menninger, if you Google that or Menninger and include the China study, she has a good multi-page review.
How do you spell?
Oh boy, I knew you were going to ask me.
Oh, I'm sorry. We'll just take a moment. We'll find that. Now, I've often puzzled.
Mm-hmm.
This I'm going to go about this through a roundabout way. I make soap. It's one of my. For some reason, I can't take. I'm not allergic to anything. I can take all foods, but I don't like wort soap, and somehow it irritates my skin. And the only soap that I found I could use was the Dove soap, which I found too expensive. And so I took to making soap. So for years and years and years, I've just made soap. And so I learned off, like I do everything, I learned everything I know off YouTube and the internet. So I followed all these people and learned how to make soap, which is astonishingly easy once you've done it once. But I was interested because one of the ladies teaching me to make soap was a vegetarian and hardcore. And she did a whole video on why she uses animal fat to make soap. And so the essential point, as I understand it, is that you can make soap out of olive oil, castor oil, but it's altogether too soft, and so you need to add in some lard. And she'd come under fire on the internet, as you can do, for using lard and using an animal fat. And funnily enough, when I talk to people about making soap, you often get women say, I wouldn't want to rub animal fat on my skin. Anyway, she was responding to that sort of knee-jerk response. And she said, well, the fat is around, right? And it makes better soap. And it's not like I'm eating the animal or killing it. It's just that it's there, you know? And so I take advantage of it to make better soap. And it occurred to me following that, that you could imagine being a vegetarian and not eating meat. But you could actually have I'm asking you this, could you have a good diet by not eating meat, but actually consuming animal fat? So you could eat egg yolks, mm-hmm. you could eat butter, you could eat cheese, you could take cooking lard, mm-hmm. And you could get quite a lot of the necessary vitamins, could you not? Without actually eating animal protein?
You could. And some cultures came closer to that, but usually they also included or prized seafood, particularly fish eggs.
Okay.
And a roe, or even the lobster, crayfish, mustard, those sorts of highly intensely concentrated sources of fat-soluble vitamins. Okay. Now, absolutely, if that works for people and they eat enough of get enough of the saturated animal fats, then yes, in all likelihood, they can have healthier babies, they can have healthier overall health outcomes. However, you know, if you include cream and fish eggs in there, then I'd say yes, it's quite likely that they can be healthy on that kind of a diet. But that is not what is included in a vegan diet.
No.
So that's
I often wonder, I've got two very dear friends who are hardcore vegans. Mm-hmm. So much so that I baked them some buns and I used a little bit of butter or milk on the top to sort of brown it off.
Yep.
And it's literally an eighth of a teaspoon. And I suddenly realized what I'd done. And I alerted them to it and they wouldn't eat them, right? They were totally hardcore.
Yes.
But I wonder if it goes like this. That they had an awful diet, like a typical Western diet. You swap to a vegan or vegetarian diet and you cut out the processed food. And in doing that, you feel great, right? Because you've basically cleaned up your diet and to that extent, you're eating better. And you don't pick up the long-term effects of not getting those necessary vitamins. Do you think that could be in play here?
I think so, yes. And I have known lots of people who have gone to a vegan diet for health reasons, and it does become an opportunity, as you say, for removing the bulk of those processed and ultra-processed, in my mind, poisonous foods. And I'll get into one of the aspects with the vegetable seed oils, why processed foods are so damaging to our health. But once they are in that cleaning out the gunk phase, and some, you know, the fasting in effect compared to what they were doing, or in effect putting themselves into a purposeful state of autophagy, which means you're eating yourself, you're cleansing out the defective or polluted cells and generating new ones. Absolutely, people can feel better. However, when that diet is continued, and there are no saturated animal fats, no egg yolks. Their wheels do kind of fall off. Their bone structure deteriorates. Their brain, their nerve coatings deteriorate. They do not have that anti-inflammatory dampening down of inflammation in their bodies that saturated animal fats or those substances high in omega-3 fatty acid provide in our diets. And when you are not able to dampen down inflammation and you're not able to add new bone cells, your teeth tend to deteriorate, your spine deteriorates, your connective joint tissues aren't replaced, and ultimately your brain does not work in the same way. So those are not places I would want to go. I'm absolutely, I think, well-informed fasting can be useful for people, but then we need to go back and replenish our store of nutrients and reconstitute ourselves from diets or from food sources and combinations that are closer to what kept our traditional ancestors healthy and which we evolved in terms of our Paleolithic ketogenic background.
I have, we're going to have a vegetarian on soon to talk through the logic of their diet, which I'm looking forward to greatly. By the way, I think I found it, Denise Minger.
Yes.
M-I-N-G-E-R, Denise Minger. And she is a great researcher and did a long, several pieces on the China study. And as I recall, I read this so long ago, I recall that she was a vegetarian herself.
You know, I'm not entirely sure about that. I have another recommendation book by Lier Keith, who was decidedly a vegan. And it's a description of her realization that she was very, very sick as a result of being a vegan since her teenage years. But in addition, she does an excellent job of exploring the reasons why people become vegetarians or vegans. And I think it's a very sensitive and informed perspective, and from someone who's been there and done that. So that's another book I recommend, The Vegetarian Myth by Lier Keith. And Lier is spelled L-I-E-R-R-E Keith, K-E-I-T-H.
It's such an interesting thing, diet, because we do it almost robotically. And this is what we like because this is what we do.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. And habit plays a great part in it. However, I consistently get feedback and read feedback from people, especially when it comes to children's and breakfasts, that when they switch from the standard, you know, what could be vegetarian or vegan processed cereal, cornflakes, Fruit Loops, you name it, and low-fat milk or any of the seed milks, their children experience a decided increase in calmness, attention span, and ability to learn. They just become different, improved versions of themselves. So what those kind of diets usually involve: eggs and fat and grains that are whole grains but have been soaked, and smoothies, lots of egg yolks, those or organ meat patties in some form. Those are the kind of higher fat, higher nutrient density, ballast kinds of meals that are not really possible in a vegan diet, but that set our children's feet on a good nutritional grounding for good learning and good behavior and happiness throughout the day.
By the way, I've experienced this in other fields that I've delved into. But if you read the Weston A. Price book, Human Nutrition and Physical Degeneration, you have to conclude that if he and his wife are right, everything that we're told by so-called nutrition experts for the last 60 years is totally wrong. And so then you could say to yourself, for you and me, that's not such a leap. Probably not such a leap for all our listeners. But I can remember doing this in the past and thinking, gosh, if this person is right all those years ago, everything we're doing now is wrong. So there must be some massive critique pointing out the serious flaws and serious holes in this study. And time again, you find, no, all there is silence. So I'm not familiar with any critique of Weston A. Price other than straw men critiques, if you know what I mean.
Yes.
But mostly it's ignored, and that kills it in of itself.
And oftentimes that is an excellent technique for skewing people's perception and their thought patterns. Don't mention it. If it's not what you want people to know or believe, just leave it out in the cold and keep repeating the message that you propaganda. Do want people. And that is propaganda. Absolutely.
Tell me, you mentioned in your note to me from and the feedback from listeners about the megafauna and the human brain.
Yes.
And I remember dim, dark reading something about this and finding it most interesting. What is that?
It is asserted by anthropologists and forensic anthropologists and nutritionists that we are human in our current form with much bigger brains proportionally than any of our closer primate ancestors that we still have access to, like bonobos and chimpanzees and gorillas, because we became, you know, dropped out of the tree, so to speak, got onto the savanna and began a life as a scavenger. So we would go behind the big lions and eat whatever was left and take the bones and crack them open with a rock and suck out the marrow. Now, bone marrow is an extremely concentrated, powerful, highly nutritious fat. It's where we create the bone marrow, create part of our immune components to be well and fight off disease. Now, excuse me, that eating that bone marrow gave us, so to speak, an evolutionary leg up on the other primates and the other scavengers, because as our brain tissue grew, literally our heads got bigger, our brains got bigger, they became more complex. We were able to perceive things differently. We were able to communicate. We were able to collaborate. And we eventually moved into hunting as opposed to just scavenging. That hunting gave us greater access to organ meat and more bone marrow that we didn't have to share. And ultimately was the basis for our becoming the species that we are today. So, yes, part of the reason is we had the ability not only to attack smaller animals, but to cooperate and think in advance to create traps for and then kill megafauna. So
of course, if anyone's tried to hunt anything from a rabbit to a deer, without a rifle, right? It's not easy.
Yeah.
It's not easy.
If you can organize yourselves to be able to take down a mastodon or a woolly mammoth, those megafauna of, you know, the Paleolithic or the Ice Age, you have an animal that is mostly saturated animal fat, who's been grazing plants, ideally green grass type plants, high in fat soluble vitamins that our bodies need, and will last for weeks and weeks or months if you store it in a nearby, you know, ice bank, snowfield, so that, you know, you've got food throughout the winter and it's very high test, high powered, fat based food.
You may be interested to know this if you don't already, but I recall reading that Joseph Banks and Captain Cook, I'm not sure which one recorded it, but when they first interacted with Maori, they came paddling out, waving, wishing to give them gifts. And it was bones with the marrow inside.
I hadn't heard that one. That's a great one.
That is a great one. But as they observed in their diaries, they looked suspiciously like human bones. and in fact, there's a great moment, because Captain Cook was a great experimenter and scientist, and he, they wondered whether they were cannibals, and they had a couple of Maori on board with them. They had to have Tahitian traveling with them. They had a couple of Maori on board, and somehow they came into possession of a head that was brought out to be a gift or something, someone's head. And Captain Cook ordered his cook to cook the brains of this head. And these Maori fell onto it like it was the greatest delicacy. And his own crew were over the side throwing up because it was just so obnoxious to them. And Captain Cook concluded that, yes, indeed, they were cannibals. And, of course, he had men on his second expedition from his other ship taken and eaten. Again, that was interesting. Sorry, I've got sidetracked. That was interesting, the Marlborough Sounds.
Mm-hmm.
Because the captain, the crew wanted to go after the Maori and wipe them out because they realized that their colleagues had been captured and eaten. And they were ordered not to, because Captain Cook had given firm instructions. And despite what to them was an incredible affront, they sailed away. Which again is just contrary to history that we get these days. The bone marrow is fascinating, isn't it? And that's why beef stock is so wonderful, properly made beef stock, where you boil the bones like mum used to and make a soup and a sauce and put it over everything, is such a wonderful source of nutrition.
Absolutely. And it's fascinating to for me to have seen the trajectory of the popularity of bone broth. Introduced by the Weston A. Price Foundation a good 20, 25 years ago, not quite 25 when they started up, a good 20 years ago, and it's just taken off. I certainly encourage people to make their own, if at all possible, but, you know, making sure we get the nutrition that can be extracted from gently cooked bones and the collagen as well. It's important to have that. I mean, the foundation for so many what we consider to be great cuisines, like French and Mediterranean and Northern European or Northern African traditional cuisines, is broth and fat.
And the sauce, what makes French food beautiful.
Butter.
Is their egg, butter, and broth-based sauces, which is the essence of all French sauces. And once you've got into the habit of making a broth, you can always readily make a good sauce. And any meal becomes delicious with a good sauce on it, and with the bone broth. Oh, my goodness. Or butter, or cheese, or cream. My mouth is watering talking. I'm a glutton. Oh.
Hope you had a big breakfast, Rodney. Should we talk about vegetable oils?
Yes, we certainly can. But before, I'm sorry to do this to you because we get such a good discussion going. Vitamin D in the equator.
How much time do you have? Okay, this is also a bit of a contentious topic. And yeah, cut me off if I go on too long. We are designed to get a fair portion of our vitamin D needs through our skin. Bottom line is, we were always told that plants are the only organisms that photosynthesize. Well, we're now discovering that humans photosynthesize through our skins as well. Several compounds. Maybe we're, you know, finding more all the time. But we, on our skin, in the presence of cholesterol that rises up through the layers of the skin, not necessarily right on the top, but there are various layers to be activated, if you will, transformed by sunlight. Okay, so in the presence of sunlight, with enough cholesterol in our systems, we, at the right latitude, the angle of the sun that comes in, we can produce vitamin D and then store it in our bodies. Part of the reason that's important is vitamin D and vitamin A need to be in a set ratio in our bodies for things to function well. Okay, so a lot of us, because of living at the higher latitudes, we're not living at the equator, for modesty and warmth purposes, we're seldom out running around with few clothes on, except at the beach. And those are usually, you know, at lower latitudes, closer to the equator. Think of all those Norwegians and Danes who, you know, inhabit the beaches of Spain in their bikinis to get a good tan to take back to, you know, their winter climates when the sun is so low that they can't actually sunbathe to get their vitamin D. So vitamin D is super important. We do not create vitamin D in the presence of sunscreen, which means we may not get burned, but we're also not creating the vitamin D and the melanin that our bodies traditionally or evolutionarily need. Okay. It's part of the reason why people at lower latitudes, closer to the equator, have much darker skin than, say, the Swedes. Okay. The Swedes' skin is, in effect, frantically trying to absorb as much vitamin D without an extra layer to deflect that sunlight, whereas people at the equator tend to have developed a layer of protection, darkening pigment that screens out part of the vitamin of the incoming sunlight to prevent excessive amounts of sunlight and burning. Okay, so it's a bit of a balance. Now, this is where it starts to get a bit contentious as to who's saying what about how long you need to be out in the sun, or at what time of year and at what latitude. Okay, so there were people who contend that at 40 degrees, which is where I am here in Waipukurau, where a lot of the Mediterranean climate is only just adequate if you are out there in sunlight between, you know, 10 and 2, just when we're told not to be out there, without most of your clothing, then, you know, you're likely to have to be creating enough vitamin D and melanin for good health. So that comes back to, well, how do we do that when that's not really socially acceptable? We're told to put on sunscreen, and even then we might not get enough. So this is why, you know, in the last 4 or 5 years, there's been so much of a shift towards vitamin D supplements. Now, I'm not a fan of vitamin D supplements. I am a fan of getting a protective tan gradually and then getting out into the sun more in that period, you know, between 10 and 12 at our New Zealand latitudes, that will result in us creating vitamin D for storage. Having said that, this past season and now with all of these solar flares, probably not a good time to start out that, you know, maybe very gradual tan, but we're kind of in uncharted territory here with these solar flares. So once again, my suggestion is we can get good sources of vitamin D from pork lard and from milk if it's raised on green grass. And the other of the fat-soluble vitamins tend to go all together in packages like with egg yolks. So in a nutshell, yes, get sun. Be a little cautious when there are solar flares. Using sunscreen, in my book, is not a good idea because it has carcinogens in it. And we may well be giving ourselves as much skin cancer, if you will, or other forms of cancer from using sunscreen in order to try to prevent ourselves getting cancer.
It is so contentious, right? Yeah, and of course, we've had years and years of slip, slop, turn over, put it on, kids covered head to foot in sunscreen. And it's like our body is supposedly not designed for the world we live in. You know, like you think, well, how did we live before we had experts telling us to put sunscreen on? Obviously, we weren't out in the sun at the equator because, as you say, you'd have the pigments. And I guess it went the other way, that originally man was pigmented and they estimate we left Africa 70,000 years ago, so it was still hot there. And then we went up and lost the pigments in order to obtain that vitamin D that we needed.
Vitamin D, yes.
And it's such – but isn't it such a – doesn't it leave you just marveling at the wonderful complexity of the human body and its interaction, not just with the food that you take in, but actually with the very environment that we inhabit, such as the sun. You just stand, and like the little bit that we learn is amazing, but it's just a small fragment of actually what's going on. So when, and this is the query that you always, to me, have about a supplement, because there may well be an interaction between the sun and our skin, which is one of those pub quizzes, what's your largest organ? It's your skin. It is an organ, and it's producing so much goodness for you that just swallowing a pill may not be the same as having sun on your skin.
Invariably, we have a fixation, or we've been taught a fixation with simplicity and, you know, keeping things simple, moving away from all of these complex processes, just keep it simple, eat this packet. It's never as good. Food, our supplements, if you will, our vitamins and minerals, are most usable and better for our health when they come in the form of nutrient-dense, clean, natural, unprocessed food that we process ourselves in, you know, in our kitchens. Because
and
there is danger, absolutely.
The danger of us swallowing a lot of supplements is you could be putting pressure on your organs to cleanse your body of them because they're getting a sense of an overload. But also it's not clear even that they're absorbed into your body.
Correct. There is contention there too. However, supplements, vitamins, minerals are one of the fastest growing health fields. Just astonishing.
Big money.
Absolutely. It is always best to embrace the complexity and the diversity of our getting our nutrition in its most natural source, because invariably corners will be cut in the manufacturing, harmful synthetic, basically pesticides or anti-rot components will be put in any of the natural digestive or other enzymes that are in our food in its natural form and good for our health will be nuked when the food is in effect pasteurized or cooked or, you know, excessively or dried or sterilized. So yes, it may be convenient, but it causes a lot of inconvenience in our health. And ultimately, you know, as our cancer statistics rise, are we trading off some time and energy and extra cost in making sure we're eating the best possible, most natural, cleanest, nutrient-dense food versus the cost and severe inconvenience of giving ourselves cancer?
You will no doubt recall, which I got following with some alarm, the big debate in Western A Price over what fish oil one should have, because traditionally people had fish oil that was fermented and not processed. And we think we're buying this bottle of fish oil or these capsules of fish oil. And we're thinking, oh, well, I'm getting my vitamin D. I'm getting my fat-soluble vitamins by taking this. But by the very process by which it gets to the bottle and sits on a ship and then sits in a store and then gets to your kitchen where it sits for some longer, the whole thing actually is not the real deal. It can't be.
Yeah.
It's do you know what we're going to have to do, Phyllis? If you think that Phyllis is onto it, take all your vegetable seed oils and pour them down the sink, right?
Yes.
Right this minute. Use lard or ghee or butter and maybe a little bit of olive oil, but I don't know if I'd cook with it. And we'll talk to Phyllis about that. But get rid of canola oil. What are the other horrible things?
Soy oil, corn oil.
Corn oil. Get rid of them.
And cottonseed oil.
What's the last one? Seed oil?
Cottonseed oil. That's what those solid white, partially hydrogenated Crisco or are made from. Okay, we don't eat a lot of that here in New Zealand, or any of the margarine spreads also are made from heavy duty industrial, highly inflammatory seed oils.
They are totally destructive, and because we've run out of time. But what we're going to do with Phyllis is we're going to cover seed oils next time she's on. If you haven't heard about this, you will be shocked to your core at what a lie has been put upon us, that this highly industrially processed seed oil is good for you. Throw out the animal fat, which is bad for you. Nothing could be more wrong. It's terrible, Phyllis. It is terrible.
It is very, very destructive of our health. I mean, I have several graphs, but one of them that really highlights it, that as from the 1920s, our consumption of butter as a proxy for the other animal fats as well has gone down, our two dread conditions, heart disease and cancer, have risen dramatically. There is not a correlation between fat consumption and natural fat, saturated animal fat consumption, and those heart diseases and cancers. But we have been fed, pun intended, a narrative by food manufacturers and processors, and to a certain extent, the nutritionists funded by the sugar and the industrial seed oil and the ultra-processed food manufacturers to encourage us to move away to more supposedly heart-healthy vegetable oils. They are anything but heart-healthy.
And how dark is it when you add to that the pharmaceutical industry coming along and saying, take this every day and you won't get a heart attack?
Yeah.
It's like a complete circle. Big pharma and big food. We're going to cover that next time, Phyllis. And it's a shocking story. We'll talk soon, Phyllis. So lovely to have you on our show. Thank you for coming on to our show. That was Phyllis Titchener. You're on Real Talk with Rodney Hyde. She always gives us the real talk, or the dinkum oil, or the dinkum fat. Wonderful, wonderful human being with a deep, deep knowledge. And I guess we call it truth bombs, just raining down on us. Give us a text, 2057. Email me, inbox@radleycheck.radio. So lovely to have you along this morning. And I'm so looking forward to Phyllis and seed oil. We were meant to get onto it today. Talk soon.
Next time is fine. Bye to everyone.
With your help, we can continue to fight for freedom. This is not possible without your generosity. Join our quest for the truth and our freedom. Simply visit www.realitycheck.radio/donate to make a difference today.